Good morning. Welcome to the roundtable and to our panel discussion for this Friday, the 12th of September, a busy news day already. And we'll bring you up to date on what is happening in just a few moments. We have a great group here today to talk about the issues, and we welcome you and your letters as always. First of all, a big shout out to Sarah LaDuc and David Gastina for manning the lockbox control center and working very hard in there. Thanks to you for heeding the call and doing what you can to fill the lockbox, WAMC.org. It allows us to have conversations exactly like the one you're about to hear and to continue to have this be a place where we can discuss these issues in great detail. WAMC.org, WAMC.org. Let me introduce the group and we will get started. Public policy and communications expert Teresa Bourgeois is here. Good morning, Teresa. How are you?
Good morning. Doing all right. It's been a week.
I'm all right.
It's been a decade.
Not great. I'm all right.
Let me say this. It is a gorgeous day.
Yeah, it's a beautiful day.
It's a beautiful day in America, yeah. And we have so much to be grateful in that regard.
One of many we've had.
It's just been spectacular.
And I just hope as we hit, we need rain, so I hope we get rain.
Saturday.
But I also hope that we are able to enjoy the splendor of the colors and the foliage.
Well, I went to a minor league baseball game on Thursday night, and it was the Tri-City Valley Cats, one in the bottom of the ninth with an amazing home run, but just a really perfect baseball night. Just beautiful, perfect weather. And then that spectacular moonrise for the third day in a row. If anybody didn't see the moonrise, oof.
I was watching the Phillies and the Mets last night, and the Phillies came back to win at 6-4. Right. And it was amazing. It was an amazing game. And my wife came in, and I was looking at it on the big TV, and she said, isn't this better than being there? And I said, no.
Not even close.
No.
Phillies had a big run against the Mets. Where's Ray? How's that?
Well, they you know, when they played them in New York, Phillies lost all four games. And then when they played them in Philly, the Phillies won all four games.
In a big way, at least one of the games.
Yeah, I think they're up 11 games, and not a shame. Well, good morning all. Welcome, and Teresa, it's great to have you here. Bo Breslin joins us, Joseph Palamountain Chair in Government at Skidmore College. Hello, Bo. How are you?
Hi, Joe. I think I'm a little bit better than Teresa. slightly better than Teresa.
Good. All right. Well, we'll get everybody on the same page here, and
I'm just worried for
what's
our country,
going on. Yeah, well, we'll talk about that. And Bill Hammond joins us, Senior Fellow for Health Policy at the Empire Center for Public Policy. Good morning, Bill.
Good morning, Joe. I will just say that I am a WAMC donor, and I encourage other people to do the same.
Well, thank you very much. We appreciate you. We appreciate all of our wonderful people who have been calling up during the fund drive, during the lockbox part of the fund drive, and helping out. I think to Teresa's point, these are precarious times, especially for public broadcasting, and everybody coming in and helping is really gratifying, but also so necessary, and we really need it. And we thank you very much for heeding the call and coming and helping us out. All right, so let's get to the news, which has changed just in the last half hour. That that's what news does.
That's why they call it news.
As of last night, when I went to bed, they were still looking for the person responsible for the shooting of conservative activist Charlie Kirk. And then at that point, the stories also showed that there was some discord within the FBI over the handling of it. And actually, Kash Patel made the trip from Washington to
Utah,
Orem, Utah, to help in the investigation. Well, overnight then, as the investigation went on, just a little bit ago, the president spoke on Fox and Friends, was there right on the couch, was there live in studio, and said that a person is in custody in connection with the Kirk shooting. He said that we think we've got him, and also that it was someone close to him that the information came from that was helpful in getting them. Subsequent reporting from a number of news agencies say that it was actually the suspect's father who recognized the photo of, allegedly, his son, and said that then confronted his son, who admitted to it, and then the father held the kid till they till authorities arrived. So that's the story that's being told right now. There is a press conference that is expected to get underway any moment in Utah. It was scheduled for 9 o'clock. It was postponed to 9:15. Then they moved it to 9:30, and it's 9:36, and we're still waiting for it to begin. We're not going to air it, but we'll certainly bring you up to date on what is happening. And the president did caution that the information was preliminary, which I assume is why the press conference has been postponed until some I's are dotted and T's are crossed. An official said that authorities were not releasing a name because they were still pursuing leads. And that is from the New York Times as of 3 minutes ago. And meanwhile, we have seen a number of, you will remember 24 hours ago as we were starting this program, there was a press conference that had just happened in Utah where we were told that they felt that through imaging software, they would be able to look at the tape and they would not need to ask for the public's help in it. That lasted until about 1 o'clock, 12:30, 1 o'clock yesterday. And they released a series of two or three pictures of a young man dressed in black glasses. You could not tell a lot from those photos. And then there was also the addition of the video, which showed the suspect running across the roof of the building from where we believe the shooting took place, and then down, jumping off the roof, going through a parking lot, and then up into a wooded area where homes were behind the college. So that's sort of where we are right now. And according to the latest, a man in his 20s was taken into custody at about 11 p.m. on Thursday night by Utah State and local police, and that according to law enforcement officials who confirmed the details regarding Donald Trump's remarks to Fox News. So that's where we are as of right now, and we will certainly bring you more as it becomes available, but I'll throw it over with that information to our panel as to what this last 24 hours has been like as we try to deal with a political assassination in the United States of America. Bo Breslin.
Joe, I think there's there's so many angles we could cover here, and you did a terrific job yesterday on the roundtable. Great panel, great conversation. Your intro here is equally solid and fantastic. I think there's some things that we probably should put out on the table that don't get a lot of attention. And so I'm going to play that role, right? We're in a tough spot. We're in a very violent moment in American history, but it's not the only violent moment in American history. There's a lot of attention paid to the 60s as sort of a precursor or at least a similar situation than here. Let's remember a couple of things. One is the country was born from violence. The reality, I'm not, and please, listeners, don't think that I'm excusing. I think it's a horrific assassination, murder of Charlie Kirk. I disagreed with almost everything Charlie Kirk stood for, but I would absolutely defend his right to sit on a college campus or anywhere else to say what he was saying. That said, the American Revolution was an incredibly violent beginning. It's part of the DNA. Was it Thomas Jefferson who said the Tree of Liberty needs to be replenished with the blood of tyrants and patriots? And so we have to remember that this is part of the history of America. The country was born twice, so it was reborn in the Civil War. That itself was part of that was a violent moment, obviously. So I asked myself, what's the common denominator? And the common denominator, assuming this gentleman who shot Charlie Kirk yesterday is sort of fits the profile, we do not know that, but assuming that he fits the profile, the common denominator is fear. This shooter probably doesn't hate Kirk, but he fears Kirk's worldview will take hold and his will be replaced. That's why John Wilkes Booth killed Abraham Lincoln, right? He feared the loss of slavery and Booth's worldview would be replaced. That's the common denominator for assassinations like this. Now, assassinations are different than war because they tend to be higher profile. They are individual, singular moments of murder. But we have to, and it's important to remember that's critically important. Assassinations as part of the violence of America has been around for a really long time. And I'll say one last thing and then open it up to the group. There wasn't much conversation. There hasn't been much conversation about the Second Amendment in this moment. And what's interesting is that the Second Amendment has come to mean an individual right to keep and bear arms. That is not what the original framers intended from the Second Amendment. And I'll just give a little tiny history lesson to think about the Second Amendment. Hopefully we can talk about it a little further. The Second Amendment, as most of you know, says a well-regulated militia being necessary to the security of a free state, the right of the people to keep and bear arms shall not be infringed. There is that prefatory statement that a well-regulated militia. But what's more interesting, and I'll stop here, is Madison's original version of the Second Amendment said this: the right of the people to keep and bear arms shall not be infringed, a well-armed and well-regulated militia being the best security of a free country. And here's the important part that got edited out, but no person religiously scrupulous of bearing arms shall be compelled to render military service in person. That conscientious objection sentence got edited out by Congress. There is no way that Madison intended individuals to have the right to bear arms. He meant it as part of a military operation. Otherwise, he would not have included the conscientious objector sentence that got edited out. That should be part of the conversation of the Second Amendment, and it very rarely is. So we have all these things that are part of this particular moment, and I'll leave it at that and just open it up to the rest of the group.
First of all, 10 points to Beau for using the word prefatory. very impressive. The whole thing was impressive. Bill Hammond.
So Beau has opened, I think, 4 or 5 cans of worms. I have 3 things I want to say in reaction. One, not just to Beau, but to the situation. First, I'm really dreading the analysis of the shooter's motives.
Yes, me too. Mm-hmm. Agreed.
People are going to, we've already had a round of that where there was allegedly things written on the bullets and people
right.
were interpreting that. There may be a clear-cut motive here, but I think the major factor is that this person was not thinking right. Like they were using violence in a situation where it should not have been used, and that is the common denominator of of all assassinations. Not, you know, I guess I would beg to differ a little bit. Some assassins have motives that are non-political. There was somebody who I believe was the guy who shot Reagan. He was doing it to try to impress Jodie Foster.
Right. John Hinckley.
John Hinckley. Deeply mentally ill.
Also, I think our I've been reading these articles, some of which you shared with us, where the theme is we're in this new phase of violence in a nation. I don't feel like, I actually feel like as a general principle, our nation, like the rest of the world, has gotten less violent over time. We were born in a revolution. We had a huge and very bloody civil war.
That's the Steven Pinker thesis.
Yeah. And I buy into it because I feel like he's presented evidence. And the articles that I'm reading that talk about this being a new phase of violence are not presenting evidence to the contrary. They're not showing, oh, here's the uptick over, you know, we have more violence now than we had in the 2010s or the 90s or the whatever. There are surveys. I think the one piece of evidence that these articles are presenting are surveys where people say they would be okay with violence in more situations. And that's disturbing. But I don't think it's necessarily taking the form of more violence, more political violence at this point. Maybe we're on the brink of something, but that's... that's not happening yet. I would just argue. I would wait to see more evidence. The final thing on the Second Amendment, I was struck by the weapon that this guy used. It was a bolt action hunting rifle, not automatic or semi-automatic in any way, a very kind of old fashioned device used mostly for hunting. That's what it was. It was a hunting rifle. I am not aware of any gun control proposals. I've been a supporter of gun control over in my life. I'm not aware of any proposals that would take that gun away from a qualified adult.
Right. The key being qualified, and you know, if there is mental illness involved there, then obviously those matters change.
Yeah.
But yes.
So I'm not even accusing this guy of being mentally. I'm saying there's a failure of rational thought in his head if he thought the right thing to do was to shoot somebody for what they said, if that's what he was doing.
I want to take a break and then come back. I want to hear from Teresa Bourgeois. And we're still waiting for the press conference. As I said, we're not airing it, but we will bring you up to date as we find out more information from it. You know, the one thing I will say, though, is that in talking to some military experts over the last 48 hours of asking the question that I was curious about, is that somebody has to be a really good shot to be able to do that. And what I have been told is that the technology is such with scopes that makes that easier, if not easy, for someone who does not have the experience of, say, a militarily trained assassin.
You can also pull that gun apart and pack it in. The other, what I heard was.
So I think those are things to keep in mind. You wonder, well, you know, how can a 20 whatever year old kid do this if that is the case? And the fact is that, yes, the technology is there to allow that to make it easier than perhaps it should be. So that's another thing to throw into the mix. We'll take a break. We'll be right back. Help the Black Box if you can. WAMC.org, WAMC.org. David and Sarah will be back in just a little bit to tell you about the importance of that. You already know the importance of that, but they're going to make that case even more so. We welcome you. WAMC.org. We'll be right back. But I won't tell you. Good morning. Welcome back to the roundtable and to our panel discussion. A lot going on this morning. We are learning more about the shooting of conservative activist Charlie Kirk. We believe that there is a suspect in custody. The President of the United States made that announcement on Fox and Friends this morning, and there is a news conference that is expected to take place at any moment in Utah, where obviously more information will be shared with the public. In the meantime, we've been discussing the issue here in our panel, and I've heard from both Bo Breslin and Bill Hammond. And now we go to Teresa Bourgeois. Good morning, Teresa.
Good morning. So appreciated the comments of each of you. I thought it was really interesting. I think we don't know, we truly don't know anything about the person who murdered him, and
no.
We don't know anything about his motivation. And I'm sure there's going to be a lot of more information will follow. There'll be a lot of hashing that out. So I'd like to focus on some broader issues. But first and foremost, I feel compelled to say also that regardless of what one thinks about Charlie Kirk, whether you were he was your hero and you embraced what he said, or you had deep concerns about what he said and that's impact on our country, the core thing is he had the right to say it, and no one has a right to murder someone for what they're saying. And so I think that that's one thing that I hope that we can all agree on. And so even if some of us have concerns about the kinds of things that he said and that he did, it is still absolutely abhorrent that he used violence and gun violence to address those concerns that he had. Investigations underway. So let's not, from my perspective, I don't want to dwell too much on the specifics of him, but I do think it's important to note that on Wednesday that happened, but a couple of other things happened. There was a shooting in a school just outside of Denver, sadly in the same county as Columbine, where two students were shot and critically injured, and then the shooter, a student, took his own life. And this has become too much a part of our everyday life. I think that gun violence is a health epidemic in this country, and that needs to be addressed. And then political violence is on the rise. And there's enormous amount of lack of safety in this country. And the question is, what are we going to do about it? Well, one of the things, you know, what are the causes? Are there mental health issues, as Bill talked about? Or, you know, what are the causes that get at this? But one of the things that happened on Wednesday is the House Appropriations Committee passed the Commerce, Justice, Science, and Related Agencies Appropriations Bill, basically to set the funding agenda on that day. And they also passed the funding for health and human services, education, labor funding. And so, you know, and I think about violence, political violence, I think about January 6th as well. And I think about what's going on with the deportation issues and the confrontation that that's causing. Well, in that funding, they have cut funding for federal law enforcement, eliminated federal agents, analysts, prosecutors' positions. I'm reading from their fact sheet. They cut resources to protect the U.S. from espionage, domestic international terrorism. They cut funding for legal services, Violence Against Women Act, juvenile justice, community violence intervention programs, hate crimes, and other violence prevention programs. On and on and on. So what kind of infrastructure do we have as a country to respond to this? And if we think of, you know, the violence and gun violence as a health issue, and you think about across the board, on the health and human services side, the amount of funding that they have cut for research, they've cut back to justice, they have cut funding for the Bureau of Alcohol, Tobacco, and Firearms to trace these kinds of things. They have moved 10 to 20% of FBI agents have been moved into the focus on deportation and away from investigating these things. So where are we going as a country in terms of addressing the things that the law enforcement aspects that make us safe, but also the economic supports that, and again, I'm not suggesting that this person had any economic issues, but in many cases, there are feelings of, you know, lack of economic stability causes concern, causes trouble. Anyway, so jobs programs, education programs across the board. So I just wonder, and that all happened on Wednesday. And I think where we go in that direction has an impact on how our country is going to respond to the moment that we are in. In what direction are we going? In what direction are we going to address gun violence? In what direction are we going to address this tearing apart of our community, this sense of isolation and lack of community? You know, where are we going as a country, and what can each of us do about that?
One of the
real quick, you got about 30 seconds. Go
okay,
ahead.
One of the virtues of the American political design is liberty is at its core. One of the problems, in light of what Teresa just said, where are we going to go, is we don't have a common vocabulary to talk across difference. I'll say there's a great, last thing I'll say, Joe, great article by Jill Lepore in The Atlantic where she says, and I've never heard it this way, but it is the problem we face. She says the left sees abortion as freedom, guns as murder. The right sees guns as freedom and abortion as murder. We cannot have a common language across this partisan difference. And until we get a common language, an ability to speak together and sit down in the same room, we're in trouble.
We'll leave it there. We'll take a break. We'll do some lockboxing, and we'll be back after the top of the hour.
Well, the only way I knew how to start.
Good morning. Welcome back to the roundtable and to our panel discussion for this Friday, the 12th of September. We mentioned to you right before the break that we were still waiting for a press conference to begin that was to begin at 9 o'clock in Utah after the president of the United States on Fox and Friends announced that, quote, I think we got him. On just moments ago, the governor of Utah, Spencer Cox, said, good morning, we got him. And the press conference continues as we speak. We'll bring you more details as they become available throughout that time. Meanwhile, our group has been talking about the issues over the last several days, this investigation, the idea around political violence and what we can do about it. We welcome your letters, please. panel@wamc.org, panel@wamc.org. We'd love to hear from you. panel@wamc.org. Teresa Bourgeois, Bo Breslin, and Bill Hammond with us this morning. Bill, Bo, we left you just, and I hope I didn't, I know you were truncated there, but is there anything else you wanted to bring?
Well, I just want to underscore what Bill was saying about, is there a little bit of a disconnect between the rise, the perceived rise of political violence in this country and the perception out there that, or at least what studies show about folks endorsing political violence. And there's some data, right, that Robert Pape, this guy at the University of Chicago, is having his 15 minutes of fame. He's super smart. But his work at the University of Chicago says this, 40% of Democrats, this is recent data, endorse using violence to remove Trump. That is a very high number, doubled in the last 6 months. 40% of Democrats endorse using some form a force to remove Trump. 25% of Republicans endorse using the military to forcefully suppress protests. 1 out of 4 Republicans, according to his data. 34% of college students endorse violence to stop a campus speech or force to stop some sort of campus speech. 1 out of 3 college students, he found. Those numbers have doubled in the last 6 months or 8 months. That what's disturbing, and this is what Bill was talking about, what's disturbing is the notion that we are willing to tolerate or think about or at least conceive of violence and force as a way to dissent. That's not what the way America should be going, and it troubles me in that regard. The reality also is that a recent study came out. And this is sort of riffing on what Joe and the great panel said yesterday. 80% of American college students admit to suppressing their real thoughts on a particular political subject for fear of being ostracized in a community, a college community. 8 out of 10. Now, not all of those 8 out of 10 are conservative, for sure, but the 8 out of 10 are engaged in a chilling effect that creates a bit of a echo chamber at a place like a college. So all of these things are part of the equation, part of the recipe here for disaster.
What do you mean by chilling effect?
Yeah, I think so. You know, I've lived on a college campus for my entire professional life, 40 plus years. I've been at Skidmore for 28 years. We pride ourselves on the ideal of a college student being in a place where there's an open exchange of ideas.
Right.
But the social and, quite frankly, political pressure to conform to particular ideology is very real on a college campus. I'm not going to say it's the closing of the American mind, but I am saying there isn't a broad, robust conversation happening on college campuses because the pressure to conform is so high, and that's exacerbated by social media.
Well, and just real quick, the idea to conform, and what I'm about to say is completely anecdotal. I have three nieces and a nephew who are of college age. And what they tell me is that they know it's fraught, so they don't talk about it.
Correct.
It's just it's out.
Correct.
It is not something they even want to engage in. Right. You ask them what are the political beliefs of your roommates that you have lived with for 4 semesters? I have no idea, and I don't want to know.
Exactly. And so imagine, I mean, I'm not sitting there. I'm no victim here. I have a privileged life. I'm blessed. I'm sitting there in my introduction to American politics class yesterday morning having a conversation about Charlie Kirk, and I have to say things like, don't record this, because I want students to have broad, the ability to speak freely, and also, be careful what you say, because at the end of the day, it can come back to haunt you. And you get people who are not willing to say what they truly mean in a college campus because of the fact that there is just incredible pressure. So they don't say anything.
It's kind of ironic because, as you were saying before, the way to get clicks, the way to build your audience in the social media world is to say extreme things.
Right.
But in other contexts, you don't want to say anything.
That's right.
Because you don't want to get in trouble.
Well, and
and they don't want the argument. That's what I hear younger people say.
Yes,
when I try
they don't
to
want
understand.
The argument.
They don't want. They just don't want to have an argument.
Right. They just want them to clean up the kitchen when they're done cooking dinner. And will they please clean the bathroom?
Which also
it's
doesn't
disgusting.
Happen.
Disgusting.
But it's like Thanksgiving, right, where people are, the family
the
gets
cleanup?
Together. No,
no,
well, that too. But no, family gets together at Thanksgiving, and let's just not talk about politics because we don't want the argument.
Right. Yeah, and that goes on over 4 years in a college campus. But one thing I said yesterday, and Bo brought it up when he came in this morning to me, I said yesterday is that if you look at what Charlie Kirk was doing on that campus in Utah, and you think, well, if it doesn't happen there, then where the hell is it going to happen? So I agree with you 100%, but he was having a debate with students.
He was, and
the community. I mean, some of those people looked older to be students. But he was having a debate. And where else do you have that? And I think you articulated this beautifully, Teresa. Yeah, I mean, the things that are said are eye-rolling in some cases and really disturbing. However, you have the right to say them, and then people had the right to respond and to debate, and that was something that he was very interested in doing. It was part of the show, and that's what he did. But it's interesting that those two things coexist.
Yeah, so the First Amendment was put in place for Charlie Kirk, right? I'll never say anything that's so controversial that I'll need the First Amendment to back me up, but I'm darn glad, that I have the First Amendment to be, in case I do say something like
First
that.
First Amendment allows you to say damn.
Okay.
It's like the...
I worry that Sarah's going to get upset with me.
It's like the... I go back to the Charlottesville, right? Where they were walking through, carrying the tiki torches, chanting, "The Jews will not replace us." Abhorrent. Horrible. No excuse for it. But they have a right to do it. But then the person, and I'm sorry to say this, but the person who then... There were protesters who drove a car into the crowd of protesters... did not have a right to do that.
That's right.
Right? Those are very different things.
Yes.
You can say things, but people can't act on that in violent ways, act out in violent ways in response. You just can't. There's got to be a line. But the question is, what has happened in our discourse? And I see it from my time in the House and the Senate and Congress, where members of Congress would go onto the House floor, go onto the Senate floor. They'd have incredibly tough policy debates, literally yelling and screaming at each other. And then they'd go out to dinner. And it's not that they were, it's a show where they're being disingenuous. They had core policy disagreements, but they didn't hate each other. They just had different policy views. And somehow, and I think we've seen this more so in the last 10 years, and I, you know, from my perspective, I'm not a historian on this, but I saw it really with Newt Gingrich, really drawing the line that you had to denigrate the people you disagreed with on policy. But this bifurcation where you can't even talk with people with different ideas rather than have these conversations where you have policy disputes, but you can still interact with each other. And I just think that there's been so much vitriol in demonizing and dehumanizing people. Yeah. And I think about the attacks on judges or the attacks on the poll workers or and certainly in terms of political violence, I cannot ever stop thinking about January 6th, right, and how dangerous that was. But how do we move away from that so that conservative kids on campus and liberal kids on campus can come together and have some fascinating, heated debates and discussions, learn from it, and go away and...
Yeah, so Newt Gingrich. I mean, that's a good sort of watershed moment, the Newt Gingrich moment in 1992. And but politics has always been nasty business, right? Sumner was beaten on the Senate floor, unconscious, in 1856. But even post 1960s, think about it. Post 1960s. It's the politics has been always a violent operation, whether it's physical, emotional, mental, or so on. It's been a dog-eat-dog world out there. When Reagan comes in the early 80s and he's targeting particular racial profiles in his war on drugs,
poor women.
That becomes a politically violent administration, right? And, you know, Clinton's had the sort of a similar approach to crime. So I'm not saying, Teresa, you're wrong. You're absolutely right. I'm saying there aren't clear moments where we've been sort of at peace in politics, especially in my 59-year lifetime.
I think I read something once about the Cold War and the effect that it had on our politics, where we had a common enemy, communism with a capital C, and also the threat of nuclear war.
Right.
And that everybody felt like, okay, we're playing a very serious game here. And as a result, there were certain areas where Democrats and Republicans came together on mm-hmm. defense, on building nuclear weapons, on. And that may have been where the origin of politics stops at the waterfront. I don't know if that's the right phrase, where when the president is overseas, you don't criticize because he's representing our country and he's representing it in a very high stakes way where, you know, you might have mutually assured destruction. The Cold War ended in 1989, and maybe that, and not long after that is when Newt Gingrich came. So maybe that was part of this dynamic where we took the gloves off rhetorically and started really disparaging people who disagree with us politically. It's something I really don't appreciate. You get it now from like the spokesman for a political candidate. When he doesn't like what the reporter is saying, he will disparage the reporter.
Right.
Like it's
the judge, the reporter, the whoever. Sorry, I'm interrupting.
I think the rhetoric, I absolutely agree the rhetoric has gotten out of control. I also think like that poll that Bo was just citing where it says high levels of people support violence. I've seen that in my personal life. I've talked to people who have said, you know, I'm really thinking maybe this is the time. I'm like, no, don't talk like that. But the thing is, it feeds on itself.
Right.
Because if one party perceives that the other party is ready to go to war, they're like, well, we got to get ready. And so the other side looks at that and says, oh, they're getting ready for war. Like, it feeds on itself.
Yeah. But
and I'm hopeful that it stays in the realm of rhetoric, which is what has been, by and large, the pattern, is that people spew a lot of stuff online, especially. People who are less online are probably less exposed to this stuff and less prone to these feelings. So far, that's been the case with obvious exceptions. Which is why we're talking about it now.
Don't you think that the use of fear as a wedge issue to either mobilize votes or depress votes is part of the problem?
I don't want to like be facile about it, but it does happen on both sides. I mean,
and it works.
The whole campaign, Joe Biden's whole campaign in 2020 was. That guy
seems
is
so
dangerous.
Unreal.
We can't let him back in office. I mean, there's an element of fear there.
It works.
Well, I was thinking about
that didn't work.
I
was thinking about
Cory
going after
Booker's presidential attempt. He's like, I'm gonna play this as a congenial, soft approach, and he got trampled in his presidential quest.
But demonizing immigrants. Right. You know, as the and now urban America, the way that's happening and, you know, those are and distorting the data about violence in the cities and stuff. Not that it isn't a problem, but on the same time, you're not dealing with the problem. You're demonizing the problem.
So those are absolutely things that happen. People are demonizing immigrants and exaggerating the violence in cities. Part of the dynamic is that you focus on the evidence that supports your own view and you're sort of blinded to the evidence that supports the other side.
I
think that happens all over the place.
I just want to give some quick updates as to what is coming out of the press conference in Utah, in Salt Lake City, Utah. Authorities have described extensive evidence that they say ties a suspect in custody to the shooting of Charlie Kirk, including statements to relatives suggesting that he committed the crime, social media messages, and physical evidence. This according to reporting from the New York Times. There were engravings on unfired ammunition left with the gun that officials believe he used in the shooting. Governor Spencer Cox of Utah said in a news conference one of them read, "Hey, fascist, catch." The governor said, adding that another read, "If you read this, you are gay, LMAO," which is an acronym, of course, for laughing my ass off. Video surveillance footage from Utah Valley University shows Tyler Robinson, who is the young man charged in this, whom the authorities accuse of shooting Charlie Kirk, arriving near the campus in a Dodge Challenger on Wednesday morning about 4 hours before the attack, according to the Utah governor. Meanwhile, Kash Patel, the embattled FBI director who has drawn criticism for his handling of the investigation, immediately thanked President Trump when stepping up to speak at the news conference, in keeping with his pattern of lavishing public praise on the man who elevated him from podcasting to one of the top law enforcement jobs in federal government. We have just about 30 seconds. I'm going to go to two letters here. And one is, Brendan writes, caveat, the assassination of Charlie Kirk was an immoral act. With that said, can we stop pretending he was engaged in good faith debates with college students? He frequently lied, distorted facts, spread disinformation, and used illogical fallacies. It is clear he was determined not to be open to the possibility that his ideas could have been wrong. And one more letter before we go over to Lockbox Central is, something I said 20 years ago was that if the hostility towards the enemy became preached by Fox News, would inevitably lead to all parts of the political spectrum imitating that bad behavior, and now it's come to fruition. We'll take a break. We'll be back right after this. What else could I? Good morning. Welcome back to the roundtable and to our panel discussion this morning. The breaking news, as we've been on the air since just before 9 o'clock and was officially announced less than a half hour ago, that a suspect has been caught and identified in the Charlie Kirk shooting. Governor Spencer Cox of Utah said a family member of the suspect, Tyler Robinson, helped turn him into authorities after Robinson indicated he carried out the killing. That follows the president of the United States speaking on Fox and Friends this morning and saying, I think we have him. All of that bring you up to date. Obviously, we'll have much more on this as it becomes available, and certainly we'll be covering it during Midday Magazine coming up at noon today.
Can I?
Yes.
Very brief kudos to Governor Cox. I think that the statements, the way he's talked about this, his measured statements have been very, very impressive. I hadn't, you know, don't recall hearing him before, but I think he's handled a very difficult situation in a very measured and great way.
It is, and has really been sort of the voice of this, the official voice of this throughout the press conferences and so forth. We have letters. I want to get to as many of these as we can because we asked you for them and you sent them and we might as well read them. Okay. Let's see. G says, I'm really tired of the phrase, this is not us, meaning that in America, this is not how we act or do things politically. Well, this absolutely is us. Some examples are Medgar Evers, John F. Kennedy, Martin Luther King, Robert F. Kennedy, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. That from G. Then, I think you were making that point earlier,
correct.
Bo.
Yeah.
Karen says, your panelist who just said that 40% of Democrats endorse violence to remove Donald Trump. Who is he quoting and what is the context of that statistic? This cannot be right and it should not go unchallenged.
Yeah, so it's the guy's name is Robert Pape, P-A-P-E. He runs an institute at the University of Chicago that studies political violence, and he has been studying this for 30 years. He was on, actually, NPR this morning about an hour ago. He's all over the New York Times. But look up his study, Robert Pape, 40% of Democrats, 25% of Republicans, and so on. It is, from what I can tell, it is a solid, credible study.
Yeah, I that number struck me too, and I wondered how the question was asked.
Yeah, polling right. is very slippery.
Right.
But and those two, it was supporting violence to remove the president, supporting the National Guard to suppress protests, or was it to enforce against crime? Either way, those
suppress
aren't
protest.
Necessarily mirror images of each other. Like
right.
they're
right.
No.
So
right.
No. But no.
That I.
Also, I mean,
at the risk, though, of, one second, at the risk of angering my fellow panelists, we tend to go down
too
those.
Yeah, too
late, Bo. I let it slide the first time, but I appreciate the writers letting
me. I mean, generally, we tend to criticize the study. There is an uptick. I think you both would agree. Bill, you said it. There is an uptick in our willingness to think about violence as a way to dissent.
To talk about thinking about,
I don't disagree with that. I just wondered when you said that data point the first time, I wondered what's behind it, what was the question, how was it asked, and the comparison. In the previous letter, one of the things, you know, this is not who we are. The other thing that I'm sick of, you know, it's not the guns. It is the guns, folks. It is the guns. So, in any case.
One thing I will say about polling, one more thing.
Yep.
Don't get me going on polling.
You asked the question.
You are on fire this morning. I like this. This is great.
Would you support violence to remove President Trump? If you don't like President Trump, even if you're not really inclined to violence, you might say that as a way of signaling that you don't like President Trump. So the question itself, and now, if they're asking exactly the same question over a period of years, and the response goes up, then fair enough. But Trump has only
been in office. It's a loaded question.
They must have, because that's not the question, folks. That wasn't the question that Robert Pape asked, right? And the way we know that question, I don't know, Robert Pape from a hole in the wall, and I'm here defending him, is that he said the number has doubled since over the period of time in which he has studied it, which is some longitudinal distance.
Well, I wouldn't doubt at all that 40% of the Democrats would like him removed from office, but it's the violent part that I question. That's the part that it seemed, you know, I don't know.
I got the data from the New York Times, so I'm assuming.
Not questioning the data, but the I do think. I don't know to what Bill was saying. I mean, I know how I would react to that. And once I heard the word violent, I would be out. I heard violence, I'd be out.
Out, right.
You know, do you support removing this particular candidate? Yes. Do you support doing this through violent means? No. I do wonder, but getting caught up in it, I don't know. Let's go back to letters. Thank you. E writes, is that right? Yeah. Trump spews rage, anger for years, stoking division in this country, and now we are divided people. We are surprised at the violence. I'm really not surprised at all. Well, this is to Bo's point earlier. There's always been violence. Yeah. We've always had violence.
This is one thing that's very different about our current situation is that the elected leader of our country, when given the opportunity to try to tamp things down and try to reconcile the fighting factions in our country, he goes exactly the opposite direction.
Right.
Like, I mean, I can't say I've read every speech he's given, but like he's never given a speech where it's like, now people, we need to get along. Like, that's just not his style. And that is like past presidents, that has been an absolute rule among presidents, that when there's a fraught situation, the president comes out and tries to calm things down. And it's often frustrating to their own supporters. Right. Like it's often they're saying something that their own supporters don't want to hear, but it goes with the job. And that's a job that Trump just does not, you know, he's not willing to do.
He uses it as a tool. And now how did we get to January 6th? Right.
Yeah. Listen to this, folks. Now, all of a sudden, I sound like I'm this like devotee of Robert Pape. He was on. I'm not. I never heard of him before yesterday. Right.
A papist. Yes.
But
the papacy it is.
Listen to this. One of his studies suggests, Bill, in response to your answer, that the key to getting past this really fraught moment is for there to be joint statements between Republicans and Democrats. So Trump and Schumer should get up there and do a joint video. Now, I'm a big I think his study is right. That to me strikes me as a little bit outlandish to think that A, they were people would do that. Democrats and Republicans would get together on a video, or B, that would make any difference.
But
that said, that's what he's saying.
There was actually a statement, I think it was like young Republicans and young Democrats in Connecticut, I want to say, they put out a joint statement saying, this is horrible, we don't support violence, you know, Charlie Kirk didn't deserve this. There are examples of that. It's just that they're not happening at the highest levels of our government.
Right. And the Problem Solver Caucus, the Democrat and Republican got on and talked about it. But what happened right after 9/11? One of the most moving moments where all these members of the House and Senate went to the Capitol steps and they started singing the God Bless America. Is that right? Yeah. And
the equivalent this time was the Speaker of the House called for a moment of silence, which I guess lasted for about 30 seconds. And then as soon as that 30 seconds was over, they started screaming at each other.
Right, because one of them wanted to pray out loud on the floor and the other day. But so it does happen. There are moments where Republicans and Democrats come together and at fraught moments. But I think that for the last decade, this leader has used this a tool as one of the key tools in his toolbox is to create these wedge moments, wedge issues. That's what he knows.
It's his superpower.
And here we are to divide people.
I do want to mention that Bo touched on this, but Robert Pape was a guest on Morning Edition this morning, and you can hear that online by going to NPR.org. Michelle Martin interviewed Robert Pape, so don't go blaming Bo. You can hear it from Mr.
directly
Pape,
from him,
Professor Pape himself. All right, a couple more letters and then we'll take a break and then move on here and finish up for this morning. You're all talking ad nauseum about political violence when you don't even know who the shooter is or what his motivation was. Far more salient is the fact that the FBI is led by a far-right nut job with no law enforcement experience who has fired or ousted many of those who do, including the former head of the Utah branch of the FBI. Every governmental institution meant to protect us, including the military, has been degraded, demoralized, and misused. We are not safe from any kind of violence. So I agree with most of that letter, except for the part about, talking about political violence when you don't even know who the shooter is or what the motivation was. I mean, I think it is safe to say it was a political assassination. The person was obviously wanted to silence that voice. And so I think there's much more to be said and there's much more to be learned, but we get a sense of what the motive was, and that was to silence that voice.
Quick comment about that, the second part of that.
Yes.
Because I agree too, Joe.
Yes.
I'm with you on that. I'm with the writer on that. I will say this is the... We continually see the repercussions of appointments by the presidential administration based not on expertise, but based on media savvy. And I've said on this show many times that the Pete Hegsets of the world and the Cash Patels of the world were picked because they are charismatic in front of a camera. That is not the way you run American politics.
And loyalty.
In addition to being... charismatic. I don't know about the charisma of Cash Patel, but they're picked because of for being edgelords.
Fair. That's fair.
They're picked for being willing to say edgy things that land in favor of the MAGA position.
Right.
And that's like it doesn't have anything to do with qualifications or whether their temperament is right for the job. In fact, I would argue that's an edgelord should have no role whatever in law enforcement. But, you know, that's I agree that the president is not picking the right people in a lot of cases.
And I think they're you know, they're picking, being picked for, because they're fealty to Trump, right? Their allegiance.
Loyalty is a big thing.
It's his thing. But I mean, what I was trying to talk about at the beginning was what I think this writer's getting at, which is the, you know, we are in this country, there is a rise in violence domestically. You know, we have a lot of domestic problems domestically. We have economic problems. We have a whole host of problems. And then globally, I'm deeply worried about what happened in Poland, what's going on in Gaza, all around the country. But they are weakening our ability to address those problems and to keep us safe. And that's why I was trying to talk about what's happening in the Justice Department, what's happening in the FBI, what's happening in Health and Human Services across the board. The weakening of our federal infrastructure to address these range of issues, our education system and on, to respond, I think, is a serious problem. Look at the lawsuit that was filed the other day from three high-level FBI officials who were fired, and how they outline the politicization of the FBI.
I want to read the four letters that we got a ton of letters, but of the ones that we chose to represent this morning. We'll get to those four. We'll take a break, and then we'll finish up. Bill writes, perhaps what is missing is awareness. I don't mean more information or knowledge. Being aware of how addicted we are to being right. With awareness, one can then have thoughts and not just react. With awareness, we can allow others to think what they think and not be so reactive, and then communication can occur. That's a very interesting, well-written point. I just assume I'm wrong about most things. I think that's just I don't have this like I'm right, and I just assume
there should probably be some kind of daily prayer that we all say where we remind ourselves about logical fallacies.
Yes, yeah, so I just
have empathy for the other's views and the other's situation.
Yeah. Chris says, I do feel there are activists that deliberately warp the language to keep hostilities up. Look at the warpage of woke and DEI. Until we find a way to address this, finding a common language will be difficult, referencing a point Beau made earlier in our discussion. Catherine says, in light of the growing polarization and pervasiveness of violence, would it make sense to broaden the scope of what political violence encompasses? And finally, we go to David. Just an FYI, I know 10-year-olds who can drop a deer at 200 yards with a scoped rifle. It ain't that difficult. That from David. We'll take a break. We'll be back. Finish up right after this.
And I'm too far along tonight to turn out the lights. I think I'll call.
Good morning. Welcome back to the roundtable and to our panel discussion this morning. I just want to thank this amazing panel, Teresa Bourgeois, Beau Breslin, and Bill Hammond. A lot of breaking news, and you've all been wonderful, and I thank you so much for being here and addressing these issues in the manner we've been doing it this morning. It's a really great discussion. If you think it's a really great discussion, you can always help out the Lockbox at WAMC.org.
Smooth.
And, David and Sarah will be back in just a little bit. But in the meantime, we'll wrap up this morning with a looking at just a couple of the other things in the news. I did have a whole list of stuff to talk about, obviously not knowing that there was going to be an arrest made this morning. I do want to take out the bullfighter with the red cloth and ask Teresa about the GOP nuclear option.
No.
Don't do it.
Republicans invoke the nuclear option in push to change Senate rules. The rules change will allow the Senate to confirm multiple nominees at once, helping to clear a backlog of appointments. And it is interesting to see this obviously all happening as you know, all eyes were on Utah, but a backlog of nearly 150 Trump nominees awaiting four votes. Your thoughts, Teresa?
So I think that Trump, as I said a little while ago, he's seeking in these appointments fealty, you know, total loyalty and retribution. Project 2025 contingent led by OMB Director Russ Vogt and the Vice President and others, I think they're seeking to really reduce and remake the federal government infrastructure. And a key part of that is controlling this nomination process to reach their goals. The problem is they've struggled with the basics of governing. And so they've not been able to move these nominations as quickly as they want to. They've been slow to, they were slow to nominate people, slow to get the paperwork to the Senate, slow to get the all the background clearances. And now that's all piling up. And also, I think because of the nature of the people they're nominating, even some of the Republicans have concerns about having to be on the record voting for them. And so they are, as I say, going nuclear using this option. Now, it's been tinkered with on both sides in the past. It's not a good thing. You know, I think that Trump has nominated some historically unqualified candidates. And so this allows basically to put them all in a group and vote for them all at once so that the Republicans say, well, you know, I didn't really support him or her. I supported everybody. I think that they need to do the tough work of governing. And this is yet another case where they're not doing the tough work of governing. And in the process, they're whining about the Democrats slowing down the process. But that's part of the what an opposition party does, what they're slowing it down because they're trying to shine a light on the qualifications or lack thereof a number of these people. So I think that this is more whining from the right.
Yeah, and this
not drinking wine, but whining.
It's a big deal. This one's a
yes.
This one's a big deal because you know, yeah, sure, Harry Reid in 2013 imposed the nuclear option for lower court judges, and then Mitch McConnell did it for Supreme Court justices.
Well, he just blocked it.
He the nuclear option, meaning the bypassing of the filibuster. This is a big deal for because of the fact that it goes to the heart of this convention-busting time in American politics, where those conventions that produce guardrails on American politics are now being basically exploded. Amy Klobuchar herself said we should confirm 10 nominees at a time. It's not the 150, and Teresa, your analysis is exactly right, but it's just part of the slow creep of eliminating those conventions that for 238 years, we're coming up on the birthday of the Constitution, for 238 years, kept American politics moving forward.
So the filibuster is not in the Constitution.
Correct.
And how long has it existed? I'm hoping you...
Hundreds of years. It was around as a courtesy. It came about as a courtesy to senators to be able to speak about particular topics.
I mean, there is an element of being anti-democratic in the filibuster.
Oh.
Because it means that the minority can overrule the majority.
The Senate is the most undemocratic institution on the planet.
Yeah, I mean, undermine
right?
that.
That's the reality.
But it's a forcing function to build consensus. You know, the first, whatever, three quarters of the program is about how we need to build more consensus. But that is essentially a forcing function to have the minority view adhere to. But I do think there's a difference between doing 10 at a time and 150. Because 10 at a time, you can bunch together some of the lower level. I'm sorry.
But what we're really talking about here is where you draw the line between allowing the majority to get work done and allowing the minority to force consensus. And that line has been moving left and right, or left and right isn't the right word, but
back and forth.
Towards forcing consensus, towards minority rights, towards majority rights. It's been gone back and forth over the years. In my lifetime, it slid towards majority rule under both parties. I'm not going to get overly exercised about the procedural issue. If there's somebody in that package of 150 nominees who you or Bo or I object to, I think that's what we should be talking about. And we can be pointing out they're doing this because they don't want to take a vote on this nominee or this set of nominees. But it, the principle here, the principle of whether it should be done as a package, whether the majority should have the right to that's a nonpartisan issue. I don't find it particularly alarming.
But Schumer tried to negotiate a package where there were a whole group of them that they don't basically have a disagreement with them. Let's move those through. And but let's give attention. Let's have time for those we do have a fundamental disagreement with. But they don't want to do that. They don't want to do that.
I'd be interested in hearing the particular people and the concerns that they have. And that would maybe that would change my mind on this. But again, the procedural question of exactly where the line should be drawn, which level of appointee should be subject to the filibuster. My understanding from reading the coverage of this is that we're talking here about lower level appointees.
It's not cabinet level.
We're not talking about lifetime appointment of judges. We're talking about people who are going to be removed the next time.
Oh, but we are.
A different
we are. They're turning the Board
of Governors. The nuclear option started when Harry Reid said, and because he was frustrated by Republicans in 2013 who were holding up Obama's lower court judicial picks. Those are lifetime Article 3,
right.
Lifetime appointments. And then Mitch McConnell was like, you did it, Harry, so now I'm going to do it for Supreme Court justices, and here's where we are. This one may, Bill, I agree with you, this one may not have the impact of the Article 3 lifetime judges, but at the end of the day, it's again another chink in the armor of what keeps American politics moving.
But one of the senators, Senator Brian Chan, said the way you untangle this is through the hard work of negotiating across the aisle, and they just don't want to do it. I mean, that for since January, since Trump has been in office, the rules don't apply to him, and they don't want to negotiate. They don't seem to have even the infrastructure, the capacity to negotiate. And one of the people they're trying to push through is on the federal board, the Board of Governors, because there's a vacancy, somebody stepped down, and they want to do it before next Tuesday, because before the next Fed meeting, right? They want to push this guy through, and they want to allow him. He's the head of the Council of Economic Advisors. So they want to allow him to stay at the White House and his position at the White House and be on the Fed. And it's supposed to be, they're supposed to be totally separate entities, right? And that's the kind of people they're trying to jam through.
You
have worked up.
We'll get the last word this morning for the panel.
Make it a good one, Teresa.
No.
I just had it.
Yeah, I just had it. We're done.
It should be to encourage people to give to the lockbox, especially if you've never given before.
That is absolutely even a better last word. I thank you for that. I thank all of you for being so great and thoughtful and passionate this morning. I do appreciate it. It was a great conversation, and it means a lot to all of us. Have a beautiful weekend. Thank you very much.
Too.
We'll be back right after this.